The Tarlhurst End Podcast.
Read the blog
on thetarlhurstend.com.
Hello and welcome to a very special edition of the Tarlhurst End Podcast. My name is Dan Wimbush, editor of thetarlhurstend.com. We won't have a main show today, unfortunately for you. If you listen to our Christmas special, you know that was it for the year. We gave you an hour and 45 minutes to get you through that Christmas period. But what we thought we would do is bring you a very special interview today. I sat down and talked with former Reading goalkeeper Shaka Hislop for about 45 minutes, covering lots of his Reading career. We spoke in detail about his memories of Elm Park and the town and how he made the jump from the United States to playing in Reading in the third tier and what ultimately led to him leaving the football club. Some great cracking details about his wages and what Reading offered to get him to stay at the club after we lost that playoff final. Talked to him about some of his wider career, including some fascinating issues surrounding his international chances with Trinidad and Tobago and why he didn't play for his country for so many years, including details of fallout with Jack Warner. Some fascinating stuff there. A massive, massive thank you to Shaka Hislop for giving us his time. Massive amounts of thanks to him. He's a busy man, obviously, as he explains. He works for ESPN and stuff now. So for him to sit down and talk to us for 45 minutes was fantastic of him. So big thanks to that, Shaka. So without further ado, I'll get on with the show. Just a couple of very quick thoughts. Obviously, I'm recording this just after we've beaten Blackburn. Got a perfectly good start to Brian McDermott's second time in charge. Got the result. Danny Williams, fantastic goal. I can't remember so many goal of the season contenders coming before Christmas in one season. Another fantastic strike. The rest of the first half was pretty scrappy, but as soon as we made that change at half-time with Pearson coming on for Matty Vidra, I thought things really improved. I thought Ola John did well off the bench as well. Just a lot of energy. You would have liked to have seen them show a bit more cutting instinct up front and get that second goal, but you can't really complain. It was a Blackburn side that hadn't lost under Paul Lambert, so to get that result was fantastic. And hopefully they can go and build on that. We'll obviously be back just after Christmas to talk on lots more on those games and how Brian's got on. So stay tuned to the Twitter feed for that. We will, of course, be back both with the main show and the podcast section with Charles Watts. But in the meantime, as I said, here is that interview with Shaka Hislop. In the meantime, please keep your thoughts coming in to at the Tarlhurst End on Twitter, thetarlhurstend@gmail.com for your emails, and facebook.com/thetarlhurstend. I'll see you after Christmas. Have a fantastic Christmas. And a very good new year.
The Tarlhurst End Podcast.
By Reading fans, for Reading fans.
Well, I'm delighted to say this week on the Tarlhurst End Podcast, to celebrate the Christmas spirit, delivered a bit of a present for our listeners, I'm delighted to join a real true Royals legend, one Shaka Hislop. Shaka, thanks very much for taking the time to join us.
You're very welcome, Dan. Anytime.
How are you doing?
Doing very well, thank you.
Whereabouts are you based now exactly? Because obviously I knew there was a 5-hour time difference, but I didn't know exactly where you are at the moment.
I'm in Boston. I'm in the US. I've been in the US since 2006, and finally settled in up in the Northeast, up in Boston.
Very, very nice indeed. I'm sure it's a bit nicer than Reading at the moment, which is cold and miserable, as I'm sure you'll well remember.
It's pretty cold and miserable here too, Dan.
Bit Christmassy though. Have you had any snow yet this year?
No, thank goodness, not just yet.
No, we're still waiting for some of the white stuff here. Not just the traditional rain in Berkshire, but oh well, we'll just have to deal with it. So, obviously we're going to talk a lot about your time at Reading, but let's go back to the very start. What is your earliest footballing memory, and was football always the goal for you?
My earliest footballing memory, just playing in Trinidad Tobago with my dad, and then you know, my brothers, and then friends, and growing up, it was just a game of love that you know all my friends played, and so as a result, so did I. And slowly as I got older, I realized I was a little bit better than them, and eventually making some of the junior national teams in Trinidad Tobago growing up. But you know, at the time, and you know, I'm kind of dating myself here, there weren't a lot of options in terms of a future in the sport, certainly not within Trinidad and Tobago. I got to graduating high school back in 1987, and pretty much the only option available to me then was to pursue a soccer scholarship in the US, which is exactly what I did.
I was going to say, you didn't come through a traditional sort of youth system. There was no sort of academy set up or anything like that. How did that transpire? How did you go from playing college football in the States to getting a trial and getting spotted by Reading?
Well, as you already said, so I was playing, you know, I played my time out in the States, and then, you know, as I was nearing graduation, I kind of trying to decide what to do. I was born in England, so had a British passport, and was looking at options, and I wanted to give football a try. If it didn't work out well, so be it. And as things happened, I was drafted by the Baltimore Blast, which was an indoor team in the U.S. And I went to school in Washington, D.C., and Baltimore was 45 minutes outside of Washington, D.C. in Maryland. There was no MLS at the time. This is back in 1992. There was no MLS. There was no professional league, even in the U.S., for me to think of as the next stepping stone. I was drafted by this indoor team, as I say, without any real ambition to play indoor. And as it happens, and you talk about, you know, lucky coincidences, Kenny Cooper Sr., former Manchester United goalkeeper, was actually the coach of the Baltimore Blast. And they just, again, lucky coincidence, happened to be touring England that summer. That would have been summer of 1992. They played a couple of exhibition games against Aston Villa up in Birmingham. Dwight York had joined Aston Villa the year before. The regular starting goalkeeper for the Baltimore Blast, he couldn't make the trip, so I played both games. And again, just by good fortune, there was a Reading scout in the stands for one of the games that I won MVP of the game for. A Reading scout was there, and Reading contacted me and offered me a trial.
I was going to say, were there any other clubs interested you? Did Villa show any interest, or do you have any whispers of other interest?
Not as far as I'm aware. I heard that Reading were interested, and I hadn't heard anything else, and that, you know, that was fine with me, you know. Not that I knew much about Reading as a club before arriving on trial in the summer of 92, but you know, it was a real and it was a real option, and one that, you know, certainly I was more than willing to take a stab at.
I was going to say, I mean, it wasn't the most glamorous of clubs at the time. We were in the third tier playing at Elm Park, which, you know, I've got great memories of, but let's be honest, it was rusty. It was falling apart at the time. So not the most glamorous of settings to come to. Was it hard to give up your life in the States and move all the way back over to England?
It was hard from a social perspective. You know, my friends and my family, I'd left my girlfriend in the U.S., thankfully, she's now my wife, so at least I was able to keep that intact. But in terms of the facilities, and this is a perception I think that people have about Reading at the time, or any lower league club. Now, again, remember my upbringing in the game. I played in Trinidad. I played in the U.S. at the college level. And I remember Mark McGee walking me out onto the Elm Park pitch when I first arrived. Again, this is on trial, not knowing how things would turn out. And I thought this was as good as it got. I thought that was as good a facility, as good a stadium as I'd played in. You know, I wasn't used to stands that held 12,000 people. I didn't notice the you know, rusty infrastructure or whatever it may be. Here I was at a professional ground in England. The pitch was flat. It was entirely covered in grass. Even that was a luxury as compared to some of the facilities I'd plied my trade on growing up, and including in the US. I thought it was the best thing I'd seen. And here Mark McGee was making all these apologies, and I was in total awe. And that is how I remember Elm Park. And of course, as my career went on, and I played not only in the second division and at the time with Reading, and you realize that there were better facilities, that other stadia, that other teams had better facilities or better training grounds or whatever it may be, I still remember walking out onto Elm Park with Mark McGee as a trialist and being totally in awe. And that is how I remember Elm Park. And to put things in perspective, and you talk about first impressions. Now, by the time the Majeski Stadium, the new state-of-the-art facility, had opened up, obviously I had moved on from Reading by which time. I'd been playing in the Premier League. I'd become used to these big, expansive stadiums, state-of-the-art stadiums. I remember playing at Elm Park and at the Majeski Stadium, and it did not impress me the way Elm Park did first time I appeared there. And that's how I remember Elm Park. So I make no apologies, or I don't buy into the, well, you know, what was it like stepping out onto Elm Park with this rusty, dilapidated stadium? That's not how I remember Elm Park at all.
Yeah, I think I had the first impressions when I was sort of 8 or 9 walking onto the Tilehurst End for the first time. I thought, this is massive, this is huge. I'd never seen anything so big. And then, yeah, you slowly get to the other stadiums and you realise maybe it's not quite as good. But I remember...
But you never forget that first impression.
Not at all.
That's why you remain a fan of Reading Football Club, whereas others might, you know, go off to you know, support other clubs that aren't local. I'm not passing judgment on that. But there is something magical about first impressions that never goes away.
Absolutely. Well, as I said, you ended up signing for the club. You were fighting out with Steve Francis, I seem to remember, for the number one shirt. You got a run in the team at the start of that 92-93 season. But then you were out of the team. I can't remember off the top of my head if you were injured or if you were just dropped. But you didn't play at all that season. Was it difficult not playing every week?
It was. Well, I came into the team. I knew I was going to be number two. Well, at very best, Steve Francis was the number one. The reserve goalkeeper was a guy called Danny Honey. He got injured in the reserves very early on in the reserves, which afforded me the opportunity to play with Reading reserves even before I'd signed my first pro contract, and I was doing pretty well in the reserves. And then Steve Francis broke a finger playing for Reading, and that gave me an opportunity to play with the first team. And I didn't enjoy it. I was thrown in at the deep end. I myself was struggling with niggling injuries for the first time in my life. I'd been training every day. I'd been training at an intensity that I'd never been used to with players that were every bit as good as me, and in many cases a whole lot better than I was. And it was a hard adjustment professionally. It was also a tough adjustment personally. As I mentioned, I'd left my family and my loved ones back in the States. I'd plopped myself down in Reading. I knew nobody in the town. The closest friends I had a couple of friends who lived in London. I would get to see them whenever I could, but even then that wasn't often. So it was a tough social adjustment, and it was tough on me professionally as well. And I didn't play well. And by the time Steve was fit again, Mark McGee and Colin Lee, his assistant, brought him back into the team. And to be quite honest, it was absolutely the right decision. I don't think I was doing myself or the team any justice.
Well, you did get your way back into the team at the start of the next season, and then you never missed a game after that. You played solidly for the next two seasons as part of one of the best Reading sides of all time. Obviously, you won Division 2 in 93 and 94, and then in 94-95, finishing second in Division 1, the club's highest ever finish to that point. What made that team tick under Mark McGee? What turned it from a sort of mid-table-ish side in your first season there to one that just steamrolled their way through?
Well, two things. And even now in my current job with ESPN here in the US, I always talk about the psychology of a team and the long-term psychology of a team. And I'm never one that buys into, you know, you have to do things in terms of the short term. So that being said, in my second season at Reading, which would have been the 93-94 season, Steve Francis was sold to Huddersfield. And Mark called me into the office. Mark and Corin called me into the office and said, listen, we're selling Steve Francis. We had to think about bringing in another goalkeeper to replace him, but we thought we'd give you the opportunity to prove yourself as number one. And that was huge for me. That really was huge. Here was, you had two coaches who were throwing their faith behind me. And that made a huge difference to me and my own approach to that season. My own self-belief, you know, quite possibly in retrospect, it might have just been the case that they didn't have the money to bring in another goalkeeper. But, you know, here, as far as I was concerned at the time, I had two very accomplished coaches showing faith in me. And I did everything I could to repay that faith. So that season, whether I was playing well or playing badly, I would spend as much time as I could on the training ground. I would patch myself up through injuries to make sure and put myself out there every single weekend. I was also the only goalkeeper on the books at the time. So it meant a lot to me in terms of repaying their faith in me. So that was the first thing as far as I was concerned. And I think we finished eighth that season, if memory serves me correctly.
Yeah.
And then the second season, I think we played our first game at home, and I think we won. And then I remember on the training ground on a Thursday before we were due to travel, I can't remember where the second game was. We were due to travel, and Mark called the whole team together on the training ground. We used to train up at Coombe Park at the time, and. And he just said, listen, I had a look at this team. I've had a look at the league. And I made a decision. We're not going to adjust to the opposition. We're going to play our football, and we're going to let the opposition try to figure out how to stop us. And right there and right then, I felt we as a team believed that we could win this league. We were in the second division, as you keep mentioning, the old second division, which is now what
League One.
I keep losing track.
Me too.
I honestly believe that Thursday, the first season of the game.
Yeah.
Right there and right then, we won the league right there, and as I mentioned, Dan, we ran away with it because all of a sudden we believed in ourselves and we believed we were the best team in the league and. Mark McGee made us believe that way, and there was no stopping us. And then to follow on from that psychology, we took that same psychology into the next season, where of course we got promoted. Where okay, we had to be a little bit more tactically aware because we were in a higher league. We were now in the first division, far better players. Everybody expected us to get relegated, but the self belief remained, and you know, I mean. But for the Premier League wanting to reduce their numbers, we would have been promoted.
I was going to say, who were the players that really made those teams tick for you? Who did you think, this is the guy that's driving us forward? What are your memories of the team you actually played in?
I think the personalities that really made us tick, Mick Gooding, without question, Kevin Dillon, who was experienced, and Kevin didn't play a whole lot. Kevin came in, especially in that second season where we finished second.
He'd left the club in the summer, hadn't he?
I thought Kevin was always a very calming influence on the field and the training ground, hugely experienced, and was very good for the dressing room. Mick was a different personality. Nick was high energy. Mick was never say die. Mick Gooding simply... He wouldn't allow this team to ever feel defeated, and you know we can talk till we're blue in the face, and we can reminisce about Jimmy Quinn's goals and Michael Jilks down and Dylan Kerr down the left hand side and Archie Lovell and how complete a striker he was and Darius Wjoucek as good a defender as he was. We can go on and on and on about that team, but I feel the two biggest influences in that team came in Mick Gooding and Kevin Dillon, players who probably will never grab a headline.
Yeah, Mick Gooding still trying to make headlines. He's on working for BBC Radio Berkshire every weekend. He does the the colour comms.
I'd probably not changed in the slightest this time.
He is very much the same, as much of a terry up in the comm box as he was on the pitch. But I mean, that second season where we did finish second, it looked like it was all going so well. And then Mark McGee walks out, Colin Lee walks out for Leicester. Mm-hmm. Did you think that the season was going to fall away at that point? Do you think that maybe if Mark and Colin had stayed, you would have nabbed that top spot?
No, I don't, and I think Mick and Jimmy Quinn, who came in and took the reins, did a good job. But like I say, I felt the foundations were laid for that team, you know, two seasons before, as I mentioned. So that their walking out was a bit of a blow, yes. And certainly when they walked out, there was a lot of speculation that I would be joining them at Leicester. That was... If that was going to happen, it was going to be at the end of the season. I wasn't going to do it at that point. You know, this team had been playing too well. We'd been promising far too much up to that point. I had no intention of leaving then. You know, who knows what would have happened at the end of the season. But the foundations were there, and it was just a matter of keeping us on those tracks, which I think we did. Which I think Jimmy and Mick did. I felt there was enough of an understanding between the dressing room and the now player managers that if things weren't right, or that we could approach them with any concerns. I didn't share those concerns that it was all going to come apart at the seams when Colin and Mark left.
No, and you carried on that form. Obviously, you were voted player of the season that year. You got all the way to Wembley, got through the playoffs. It was a fantastic win up at Tranmere. Still one of my favourite ever away days. And then held on in the second leg, that 0-0. Got to Wembley. We all know, unfortunately, what happened. How did you see it? How did you see that game go from, I said, 2-0 up? Was it all just down to Archie missing that penalty? Or was it already a case of Bolton were coming back?
No, well, I'll go back a little bit. I was thinking about this a couple of weeks ago, the 0-0 at Tranmere at Elm Park. I don't think there's ever been a better 0-0. I've ever played a better 0-0 in my life. We did the hard work. We did the hard work of a Tranmere, and I remember playing at Elm Park and thinking, right, we're not going to concede. And I remember the fans did not stop singing all game long. It was the best atmosphere for a 0-0 anybody has ever seen anywhere.
We were packed in. I remember we even had half of the away, the old town end. We had half of that.
And did not stop singing. This was a 0-0. This was a 0-0 where we were like, you have to... Did we win 3-0 up at...
3-1, yeah. We took 3-1.
Up at Tranmere, like, yeah. Right. Whatever happens, we are not going to concede. And the fans did not. I've never seen an atmosphere for it in a nil-nil ball draw, as it were. But anyway, and then moving on to Wembley. I try telling my kids this now. I have never ever criticized someone for missing a penalty. Never, because I do not have the backbone to step up there with everything on the line. Even from 12 yards out, I'm quite comfortable being in goal and trying to stop it. I do not envy the guy on the other side of the penalty spot, as it were. But if that penalty were earlier in the half or in the middle of the second half, psychologically it would have been different. But for it to come right before the break, as it did, you just fear that you felt the momentum shift. From both our sides and from Bolton, and especially from Bolton. I mean, we go into the break 2-0 and you know, we're feeling good about it. And now Bolton are looking for something, anything to hold on to in terms of, you know, they could get themselves back into it. And missing the penalty right before the break, I think was exactly that. For instance, if Archie had missed that penalty when it was 1-0 and then we went on and scored a second in the first half and went into the break exactly the same, 2-0 with a missed penalty, no question, in my mind, we would have gone on and you know, completed the job. Had Archie missed that penalty in the middle of the second half, no question, in my mind, we would have gone on and completed the job. But I'm a big proponent of the psychology in the game, or as you know, a lot of people here in the US refer to it as the game within the game. And I feel right before the break can kind of hurt us. Or certainly it gave Bolton the boost that they needed. And let's be honest, Bolton were a bigger club, spent more money, had better players. We just had a better dressing room. We just had a better self-belief. And eventually, as you know, their quality just kind of told in the end and wore a stone.
Still feel Jason McAteer should have been sent off for the foul on Jilksy. Still think he should have got a red.
Yeah, and to be quite honest, I still think I should have seen, was it the first goal from De Freitas? I thought I could have dealt with that better. But anyway.
The only other bit of trivia from that game, which I always liked, was your goalkeeping kit that day. There's a story behind it. Just out of nowhere, you're wearing this funky yellow design with some blue arrows and stuff. I'll try and put up a picture when I put up this episode on the show to see show people what it was like. How did that all come about? Because it just seemed to come out of nowhere.
It did. They just brought in some new kits for the game, and
is it right that you had a hand in designing it?
To wear, and that was it. I don't think I'd ever worn that kit before.
No, because there was an urban sort of myth going around that you actually had a hand in designing it. That's not the case, then.
No. I do not have a creative bone in my butt. I wouldn't even think about getting involved in that at all.
Okay.
And judging from some of the kits I've worn, quite clearly, I wear anything you give me to wear.
That Newcastle number the next season was a funky one as well. That purple one. Speaking of Newcastle, then, so we lose the playoff final. The team's broken up. At what point did you decide it's time for me to move on? Was it immediately after that, or was it once a club came in for you, or had you already sort of made your mind up, it's time for me to move on? Because obviously you'd spent 2.5 years there as your first British club. I mean, was it tough to leave Reading?
It was, but then you know when you consider who came calling, I couldn't turn my back on that opportunity either. And you know, at the time of the playoffs, there was a lot of speculation that clubs were interested and what may lie ahead for me professionally. But I'd had no official contact from anyone. All I knew was what I read in the papers, just as much as everybody else did. And I was just waiting to see. And then, so that's summer of 95. I got married in 95. So went back to Trinidad and Tobago for that. And then came up and, you know, went straight into pre-season. So I'd actually pretty much switched off from, you know, what happened and had to move on quickly for obvious reasons. And then when we came back after pre-season, it was only when we went out to Ireland. We went out to Ireland on a pre-season tour. And I started getting calls from my agent at the time saying that Newcastle were very interested. They were about to table a bid. And that's when it became very real. And that's when, you know, and especially when you think of you know, the team that Newcastle were building at the time, Kevin Keegan in charge. They just signed Les Ferdinand, Warren Barton, David Ginola. I couldn't turn my back on that opportunity. And once that interest had been confirmed and a bid was placed, things kind of came together quickly after that.
I was going to say, no one will obviously blame you for taking that move, but was it a case, did Reading want to keep you, or was it a case of, look, it's a lot of money, we need to take this money?
They did. They did make me an offer, an increased offer on the salary that I was on. Just to put things in perspective now, let's see, my first contract, I was on 20 grand a year. I was on a full £400 a week.
Wow.
Yeah. So then
I think Lionel Messi's made that in the time we've been speaking.
Probably. And then I signed a new contract so my first contract was for 2 years, 92 through 94. So I signed a new contract when we got promoted and were playing in the first division. That was for a hefty 60 grand a year. And then Reading offered me, I think I'm right in saying that they offered to double or triple my wages. I can't remember if it was to 120 or to 180, but it was somewhere around there. So
still around 2-3 grand a week, which today would seem nothing.
Exactly. Which is exactly my point, you know. But that was, and even then that was a lot of money. I was very tempted by it, but and to be quite honest, I signed for Newcastle for not a whole lot more. But the opportunity to play in the Premier League with a team like Newcastle, who I felt would be challenging for Premier League title honours, was too much for me to turn my back on.
So he went on to Newcastle and moved around a couple of times after that, to West Ham, to Portsmouth, back to West Ham, and whatnot. You did end up coming and playing against Reading a couple of times towards the sort of end of your career as well. I remember you coming back in 2001. I think it might have even been on September the 11th.
It was.
For the League Cup game. And I remember you getting a really good reception. There was some good banter with the southeast end of the stand. I mean, what do you remember? Obviously, a very emotional night for everyone playing, but what was it like coming back, especially to face your old club on a night like that?
It really was special. And well, the magnitude of the day itself and what was happening in New York, I never realized. We arrived at the hotel the morning, I guess, just as before anything was happening. And then, you know, we had our pre-match meal. My routine from then would be to go up to my room and have a sleep and just get ready for the game. I didn't have the telly on, didn't have the news on, so woke up, switched my phone on, and a friend called to tell me about, actually at the time, the first call I got, only the first plane had hit. So I, at that point, everybody's still speculating that it was an accident. But after that, I switched my phone off because now, it's, two or three hours before the game and my focus is firmly on the game. And good friend of mine with the national team, Tony Rogier, was playing as well. So that was that was also, added spice for that game. And then, the banter with the fans, absolutely fantastic. I was delighted I was able to come back and play. I'd been back and visited and watched games, etc. But to be on the field, it was great to be there. And I think I'm right in saying that game finished as a 0-0 and then Reading won in penalties.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
But yeah, it really was a special night. And then, as you say, you go from a kind of emotional high, or the emotional high of that situation, for me personally, and then to realize what had been happening elsewhere kind of brought things down with a bump.
Absolutely. I was going to ask you a couple of questions on your international career, but before we leave the club side behind, you had some fantastic times, obviously winning promotion with Reading and getting some good finishes in the league. I think you won promotion with Portsmouth as well. But you had a series of heartbreaks as well. And we had one question from one of our editors. And he said, what was more heartbreaking for you, losing that playoff in 95, seeing that 12-point lead with Newcastle evaporate the following season, or right at the end of your club career, losing that Gerrard final, that 2006 FA Cup final? Which of the three stung the most?
Jeez, I'll tell you what, it's probably the Gerrard goal in 2006, because as it turned out, that was my final act in English football. And I made this joke kind of tongue-in-cheek, but I played in England for 14 years and represented Trinidad and Tobago for, on I think 25 official occasions. I mean, I had a long sabbatical for reasons I won't get into. But anyway, so my last game in English football was that 2006 FA Cup final. And straight from that FA Cup final, I went to join the Trinidad and Tobago national team. We went to the World Cup. First game of the World Cup was
Sweden, was it? Yeah.
Sweden 0-0, which, a lot of people remember. The second game was against England. Peter Crouch scored in the 83rd, and then Steven Gerrard scored in injury time at the end of the game. And there was some controversy around the Peter Crouch goal with the pulling of Brent Sancho's hair. And for a career that lasted 14 years in England at both club and international level, I'm remembered for two games, the 2006 FA Cup final and Peter Crouch pulling Brent Sancho's hair for England to get the better of Trinidad and Tobago in the 2006 World Cup. So that kind of sums it up. But so anyway, to answer the question is 2006, just because at least, that was the end. And I knew at that point that I didn't think I was going to come back to English football. I'd planned to move out to the US, and was trying to do that deal at the time. And so I knew that was kind of my last hurrah in English football, as it were. Losing at Wembley in 95, this was pretty much at the start of my career, and I felt you know, had everything in front of me. The following season, that lead dissipated. But again, this is very early on in my career, and I feel that there's so much, there was so much more to come, or there was opportunities to put that right, to write the records. In 2006, I knew I was about to leave English football, and there was at that point nothing I could do about it.
Yeah, well, as you mentioned, you played 25 odd times for your country. Didn't play more because of, you know, at one point you had declared yourself for England and then didn't. Do you regret not playing more international football?
No, not really. And the big story behind that sabbatical, as I mentioned, was Jack Warner, who now everybody's kind of understanding.
Not a very nice character.
Everybody's understanding the issues that I faced. Jack Warner and I did not see eye to eye, for want of a stronger expression. And I decided I wasn't going to go back and play under those conditions. And I didn't want to go back and play while he felt that he could strong arm my career. In the end, I realized that, you know, I wanted to play for Trinidad. It was a calling of mine. So in the end, I kind of had to bury the hatchet and swallow some of my self-pride to at least realize that ambition of mine, which is why I did go back when I did, and I felt it was at a point where Jack Warner could not have the influence that he was trying to. You know, Jack Warner tried to have me banned when I was playing for Reading because I didn't want to come back for a meaningless friendly that was outside of a FIFA window. Jack Warner tried to manipulate my career. At one point when I was playing for Reading, I called the Trinidad Football Association and said, I am happy doing what I'm doing. I have a contract. I'm insured as a player, but the local players in Trinidad and Tobago weren't. And I wanted to make sure that they had insurance. He sold that to the local media in Trinidad and Tobago, that my demands were too high. And I, of course, was chastised for that. And so it's just a lot of, you know, naughtiness around what he and I went through at the time that didn't rub me well at all. But as I say, in the end, I swallowed self-pride just to realize a personal ambition. So I have no regrets for not going back when I did. I believe that my stand was right. And I given the choice to do it all over again, I absolutely will.
Well, the thing is as well, it wasn't just that, you know, you decided not to play. You were actually really close to the English squad. I think you got sort of in and around the English squad. I think you played a game for the under-21s. Did you feel you had a realistic chance? Because England were going through a bit of a, you know, David Seaman was there, but there wasn't really a clear sort of hierarchy at the time.
I did. Actually, I played for England Bees. I was on the bench for an England international. Nigel Martin played against Chile for a full international. I think that might have been in 98. Is it late 97 I'm pretty sure it was early 1998. England played Chile in a friendly. I was on the bench for that. Later on, the under 21s, I played as an overage player for England under 21s against Switzerland. Had a horrific game, right, as it happens. And then actually that summer, Kevin Keegan asked me wanted to name me as in the England squad for, it might have been Euro qualifiers, now that I think about it. Might have been for the Euro qualifiers. No, it would have been the following summer, so summer of 99.
Yeah, so it would have been for Euro 2000, the qualifiers for that.
Correct, yeah. They wanted to name in the squad for, and you know, so as they always do, they call and let the players know beforehand that they'd be part of the squad. And I declined the invitation because I'd made up my mind that I was going to, as I said, kind of look past the problems, the personal issues between myself and Jack Warner, and go back to represent Trinidad and Tobago. So I turned that down. That, of course, I certainly never spoke about it in the media, and nor did Kevin.
Absolutely not. Well, as I said, you know, you went on, you played in a World Cup, so I don't think you know, and that's something that will always do with you. I said, I remember you watching that, and as a Reading fan, full of pride, seeing you line up in that game. It was fantastic. You know, obviously wanting England to win, but wanted you to have an absolute blinder, and you didn't do yourself any harm whatsoever. So you sort of went out at the sort of the very top at international level. But obviously, giving us a lot of your time, I'm gonna let you go soon, but just gonna ask a few quick fire questions for
you.
First one. What was your best Reading game? You know, you mentioned the atmosphere in that 0-0 game. What was your best performance?
My best performance for Reading? I have no idea. I cannot think of one individual game that stands out in all honesty.
Or a favourite game then you played in, maybe the team one or what? A game where you just thought that was brilliant.
My favourite game was that 0-0 against... With no question, it was the best atmosphere I think I've ever played in, certainly at Elm Park.
That Brighton, the game where we sealed promotion as well the season before, that must have been great with the pitch invasion and lifting the title.
That's right. And we had some special time.
Excellent. Any game that you just wish that a hole had opened up in the penalty area and swallowed you?
Oh, more than a few. Again, for Reading, I can't think of any for Reading. But there were a ton. I mean, for Newcastle, for West Ham. I can't think of any for Portsmouth per se. Certainly Newcastle and West Ham. I had some days that I just wish that I could have back. But you kind of learn that, listen, if you want to stay long in this game, you just have to put yourself back out there and... dig yourself out of that hole somehow. But yeah, I don't want to relive those right now.
Absolutely. Your favourite ground you played in?
My favourite ground, Anfield. And I've never played for Liverpool, and I always enjoyed visiting every single time I visited Anfield. And I played there in one of those famous / infamous
4-3s, yeah.
Against Liverpool. And I always loved playing at Anfield. I thought the fans there were special.
The best manager you played under?
Best manager played under Leo Benacca for the Trinidad and Tobago national team, when he was the one who was the architect behind our qualifying for the 2006 World Cup. And I feel I maintain to this day best manager I played under.
Finally, in the quick fire round, Sir John Medeski celebrated 25 years as chairman, or since he took involvement in the club recently, led the teams out onto the pitch against QPR the other day. Have you got any Sir John stories to share with us?
Not a whole lot. I remember going to his house and him showing us his new Jaguar XJ220 when that first came out. He was a man that kept himself to himself. What I tell you what, one of the things that kind of always struck me as that I remember was he was very good friends with, who was that?
Yuri Geller.
And I remember before one game, Mark McGee is trying to give his team talk, and in walks John Medeski with Yuri Geller. And Yuri Geller proceeds to bend spoons in the dressing room and talk about the men, about how strong your mind is and whatnot, and left poor Mark McGee with no time left in his team talk, and everybody in the dressing room just looking around at each other and wondering what on earth just happened here. It was so funny, and I've never forgotten that in my entire life. I always remember that.
I have to ask you as well, you know, you mentioned it was a tough social adjustment coming over to England. So any memories of certain establishments in Reading that you frequented? The name Utopia frequently comes up amongst the ex-players when they're talking on the radio these days.
I've had my fair share of nights in Utopia. That's right. I would say no more than that,
Dan. It's going to be in IKEA now. They've knocked it down.
Have they?
Yeah, it's gone. It's long gone.
It's just something about... I can't go there and buy a DIY sofa. You can't buy a DIY sofa in Utopia. It can't be done. Yeah. It's just not right.
Absolutely not. And just very finally then, before you go, tell us what you're up to now. Obviously, working in the media, what's your sort of day-to-day and week-to-week life like now?
As I mentioned before, I'm working for ESPN out here in the US. So covering the game at the highest level. including the Premier League, but all the major leagues across Europe and some of the bigger ones on this side of the pond as well. We do a show that goes out here in the US. We're on in the Caribbean, in Asia, in Australia. We're also on in the UK on BT Sport. It goes out 6 days a week. I'm generally on there 3 or 4 times a week. And that's what I'm doing. And that's my full-time job. So between that and 5 kids at home now, well, 4 kids at home. My eldest is at university out in England.
Any of them likely to follow in your footsteps?
Well, my eldest dances, and as I say, she's out in England. My second daughter does gymnastics, and then my youngest three, they all play football themselves. So 4 girls and a boy. The youngest is a boy. So I have 2 girls who were playing football, and my little man is also playing as well. And we'll see. Right now, I ask no more of them than my dad did of me, which is just enjoy the game and have fun with it.
You get
as long as they do that, I'm very happy with their continued involvement.
I was going to say, you're good friends as well with Brian Lara. I don't suppose they've tried to tempt him with a bit of cricket. Were you ever tempted?
I played cricket with Brian growing up. And actually, Brian played in a couple of national football teams, under 12 and under 14, I believe. He might have even played under 16 national football with me growing up. But then, you know, at that age, around 15 or 16, you have to pick one sport or the other. You know, at that point, it starts getting a lot more serious. And he went off to cricket. I stopped playing cricket and focused on football. But that was as far as my own cricketing career went.
I don't think you picked too badly considering where you ended up.
And then, nor did he actually.
No, he did all right. He was okay. He could bat a little bit. Very final question before I do let go. Really appreciate you taking the time to speak to us. Then you obviously do keep an eye on football and the results. How do you see Reading at the moment? Obviously back in the Championship. We've just sacked Steve Clarke as we're recording this. It looks like Brian McDermott's going to get the job back, although this is going to go out in a week or so, so we could be horrifically wrong. But what do you make of the club in general and where it stands now, and what do you sort of think the potential is for it?
Well, I think the club has a very good infrastructure, and that hasn't changed. And speaking of not changing, I was looking at the Reading QPR game on recently, and John Medeski himself hasn't changed a bit, has he? But I think there's some issues there for Reading to address, their lack of scoring, but the infrastructure remains strong, and I expect to see Reading back in the Premier League, or certainly challenging at the top of the Championship before long. But you just wonder how difficult it is for a club like Reading to maintain themselves, to have any level of consistency in the Premier League. You know, it's such a competitive league, as is the Championship, and little room for error. So despite the infrastructure being very good at Reading, I don't know if I'll see a point where Reading, a Premier League club, challenging at the top without any real fear of going back down. I just wonder if they become one of those yo-yo clubs between the Championship and the Premier League. I don't see them as being a club that belongs any lower than the Championship.
Well, fingers crossed. I said it'd be great to get win back promotion to the Premier League. I know our new tyrant has got grand ambitious plans for the club, but so have half a dozen others, so we'll have to see where it goes. But Shaka, thank you very, very much indeed for giving us your time. Great to hear you doing well, and great to hear some of those stories about Elm Park and things like that. Where can we follow you on social media? Where can we get our Shaka fix?
On Twitter, at Shaka Hislop, as simple as you like. I don't tweet a lot. I'll be honest with you, Dan, I'm not a huge social media fan.
It is a jungle out there.
It is a jungle. I'm not on Facebook. I don't do any other social media apart from that. So that's about as good as it gets for me in in this new age of all-inclusive social media.
I can't say I blame you on bit. Well, Shaka, I said thank you very much. Have a fantastic day, a great Christmas, and maybe we'll catch up one day soon. Hopefully we'll see you back at the Medeski one day.
I'm sure you will, and hopefully before long. Merry Christmas to you and everyone all there.
Get social with the boys.
Find them on Twitter
at the Tarlhurst End
and facebook.com/thetarlhurstend.